I'm David Hatfield, and this is Classical Music Connection. Major support for Classical Music Connection is provided by Matinee Musicale Cincinnati. Let's find out what's on today's program. In the BBC Music Magazine for July of 2022, we learn about the relationship between Dmitri Shostakovich and Mieczysław Weinberg. At the outbreak of the Second World War, Mieczysław Weinberg, a Polish composer of Jewish descent, fled to the USSR, where he met Dmitri Shostakovich, who became a close friend and colleague. Weinberg was profoundly affected by this initial meeting and would later describe it as if I had been born anew. It was at Shostakovich's urging that Weinberg moved to Moscow in 1943. But in 1948, several of his works were banned, and his father-in-law, the renowned Jewish actor Solomon Michaels, was murdered on Stalin's order as part of his plan to liquidate Jewish culture. Over the next 5 years, Weinberg himself was a target of Soviet agents, and in 1953 he was arrested on charges of Jewish bourgeois nationalism. Shostakovich wrote to the authorities on his behalf and offered to look after his daughter if his wife was also arrested. But Weinberg was saved by Stalin's death the following month. Thereafter, he continued to compose and to speak with Shostakovich daily. His works feature a number of explicit references to his mentor. His 12th Symphony is dedicated to Shostakovich and quotes from a number of his friend's works. The admiration was mutual, and Shostakovich likewise drew inspiration from Weinberg, dedicating his 10th string quartet to the younger man. There were general stylistic similarities too, though both composers maintained highly distinctive individual voices. In the May 2022 edition of the BBC Music Magazine, we get to interview rising tenor star Penny Patti. Where were you born? Apia, Samoa. What would be your career highlight so far? Stepping in to perform the title role in Gounod's Romeo and Juliet at the Opéra Comique last year, which tested me physically, mentally, and vocally. I was in the midst of performing in Verdi's La Traviata in Amsterdam and had to learn everything on the train. Who would be your musical hero? Luciano Pavarotti had the quintessential tenor sound, but he also brought opera to the masses and was what was needed to strengthen the art form. What would be your dream concert? I would love to perform with Adele. A pop diva collaborating with a classical divo would be rather exciting. In the BBC Music Magazine for July of 2022, Ariane Toch reviews the varying theories of string playing style and technique. When you think of your ideal violin sound, one you would be happy to be stranded on a desert island with for all eternity, what comes to your mind's ear? I was brought up on the golden caramel of Itzhak Perlman and the brassy perfection of Yasha Heifetz. Later, I discovered the more fragile beauty of Fritz Kreisler and Joseph Shigeti. In recent years, it seems that sound worlds have become more diverse and even extreme, with airier, delicate colors and textures at one end, and sustained intensity at the other. How have these developments come about, and what are the implications? Perhaps the greatest influence has been the period performance movement. As violinist and pedagogue Antje Vaidas explains, it started to change with historically informed players and Nicholas Hanencourt. You could hear how it was possible to play in a different way that was more fitting to the style. It gives us so many more colors and possibilities of expression. Every composer needs a different sound, a different approach. Our job is to be so flexible that we can adjust to the language of the composer. There seems to be a more exploratory sense of what sound can be. Victoria Bulova, who was brought up in the Russian school, but now crosses between Baroque and modern setup, says, "There are so many nuances and subtleties in music making. It's about pressure, speed of the bow, how much vibrato to use, how fast vibrato is, how much you turn the bow, how much hair goes on the string. There are so many little things to play with. When I practice, I experiment and make the phrase alive, and then I change my mind the next day. It's a constant change, and it's much more interesting." The best period performance bands and players have brought a fresh sound to composers we thought we knew, through understanding how the original instruments were played. Inevitably, however, some people have taken it too far. Alfred Brendel describes the extreme version. "It is distinguished by very little vibrato, if any, producing a painfully artificial, lifeless sound on long, sustained notes, averse to any cantabile. For quite a few players, this has become standard practice in pianissimo sections. The sound, instead of ominous or mysterious, becomes dead. What is lost in this kind of playing is a great deal of warmth, color, character, and nuance. Until the day before yesterday, string players as well as singers made use of various kinds of vibrato, faster and slower, wider and narrower. Fast vibrato seems to have become extinct. This style is not even historically accurate. As Robin Michael, cellist in Period Orchestra Les Siècles, points out, people have this idea that period instrument specialists play with no vibrato, but it's not true. The most important document we have is the treatise from Leopold Mozart. He talks about vibrato as being first and foremost to help the resonance of stopped notes, and says that it can also be used as an expressive tool. There's still this idea that when you play Bach, you shouldn't use vibrato. It's nonsense. Sound should never be dead unless it's a very specific effect that the composer wants. At the other end of the sonic spectrum is a sound that can be too present. Violinist Levon Chilingirian, whose quartet celebrated 50 years in 2021, describes this trend in chamber music. "There's a much more liberal use of the bow, and a sort of wall-to-wall legato, a sound that doesn't breathe, which has become more prevalent." He relates this to the necessity of filling bigger halls, particularly for quartets who might be more at home in smaller venues. The more famous a group becomes, the larger the halls they are touring in, and they have to develop a bigger way of playing, which goes against the music of the great masters. It's not designed for these huge halls that we play in. If you're spending most of your time playing in halls that don't help you, perhaps you are forced to develop ways of playing which are almost unnatural. Is it possible that some of the more extreme new sound worlds aren't only driven by musical considerations? Brendel suggests so. There has been a very strong generation of mainly female violinists and brilliant string quartets with whom to compete would have been a tall order. Why not do something essentially different? Something the older generations of players have not done. And isn't it desirable for the younger players to present a markedly different approach anyway? There is the danger of mistaking musical performance for a series of fashion shows where the newest brands are presented and eagerly absorbed. With streaming services and the internet offering us constant, unlimited choice, maybe there are commercial needs, too. For younger generations, says Vaitas, it's hard to find a place in the market, so they try to be extreme. Chilingirian understands the urge to be different and doesn't mind as long as it is done well. It's natural for the young ones to say, let's do something new. Let's do it our own way. If they are musical, whatever they do, even if it's weird, I would respect it because I can feel that they feel the music. To what extent is sound defined by teaching? Chilingirian reflects, I thought I could recognize the menu and sound instantly until the first time I heard a recording of Ionescu play. And then I realized Menuhin sounded a lot like Ionescu, and Ionescu was his teacher. Having said that, he recalls his own teacher, Manoug Parikian. He managed to produce me, Irvine Arity, and Monica Huggett, and look how differently we turned out. He was saying the same thing to all of us. A good teacher tries to develop different talents in different directions and not to impose their own personality. This was also something Vaitas tries to achieve in her teaching. Very often, young players start to play too loudly, with too much pressure, because they want to create a big sound. But for everyone, there is a way of producing a natural sound. It has to do with the right arm, but also the position of the instrument, the use of breathing, and the whole body. If they achieve the right balance, everyone can create their own unique sound. There are gaps in today's teaching, though, according to Robin Michael. People have lost the art of how to play proper legato with the bow, which is why they rely on the left hand, he reasons. There's so little attention paid to how we construct and inflect phrasing with the bow. People often fall back on thinking of the long line and vibrating on every note to get to the end point, ignoring all the different harmonic inflections. These things aren't talked about enough at conservatoire. As for my own love of Kreisler, for some, that type of sound is now seen as archaic. I hear discussions about beautiful violin sound, but what is that? Asks Vaitas. Nobody can explain it. Is it what we have in our ears from the past? Is it Kreisler? It was beautiful for him and for his time, but is it always fitting to the pieces? Michael agrees and looks to something much older. People talk of having an expensive sound, but I don't care about that. The golden age for me would have been people like Spohr, Romberg, and Dupont. Not the post-Second World War Kreisler school. I love listening to Kreisler, but he initiated the style of vibrating on every note, and it would have been alien for Brahms to hear his music played like that. Chilingirian disputes the idea that older generations of players paid no respect to the past. I would contest the fact that the great older quartets were not as technically or as musically good. They were just as good and much more musically informed than many of today's groups. He also suggests that some extremes may sometimes be a distraction. A really original musical personality of the Amadeus Quartet, or Fritz Kreisler, now seems to be substituted with false musical statements. With a lot of musicians, including quartets, but others as well, pulling things about too much. So it seems that along with the sonic changes brought about by increased historical awareness, a schism has developed. On the one hand, a belief that the ideal sound is relative, defined by the composer and their era. On the other, that great players can and should have their own personality, which comes through their sound. An analogy might be the difference between great actors who carefully transform themselves into each role through their gestures, voice, makeup, and even weight, and those who invariably look and sound the same. Their personalities are compelling, yet they are never not themselves. Maybe Kreisler playing Beethoven does sound like Kreisler playing Kreisler. I will always love his sound, whatever he plays, just as much as I love hearing good period players don their mantles. I hope there will always be room for both approaches. Many historically informed performance practices have become mainstream. Yet, Alfred Brendel suggests several of its norms are not fully supported by the evidence. Some players give the impression that a public decree was issued somewhere around 1801, which prescribes employing vibrato and playing on steel strings. Beethoven was Haydn's and Mozart's younger contemporary. The Scheppenzeit Quartet had already played for Haydn before being at Beethoven's service. The development of string playing and string instruments from the Baroque into the 19th century was very gradual. Levin Chilingirian is wary about modern Urtext editions. You get squeaky clean editions where there are many possibilities for unnatural playing. The quartet players who made editions 120 years ago knew Brahms. They couldn't all have been wrong about their bowings because they probably played to Brahms. For Antje Vitas, HIP is now less doctrinaire. 70 years ago, there was a dogma about what was allowed or not, but now these ensembles all play differently, which is probably how it was in every city 300 years ago. Every city had a different musical approach. In the BBC Music Magazine for May of 2022, we get to interview rising conductor star Charlotte Politi. Where were you born? Paris, France. What has been your career highlight so far? Moving to the UK and having the opportunity to be affiliated with great organizations as the Constant Lambert Fellow with the Royal Ballet and Birmingham Royal Ballet, and assistant conductor of the City of Birmingham's Symphony Orchestra. I immediately felt at home. Everyone is supportive of my artistic and career development. Who is your musical hero? Claudio Abbado drew me into conducting, as I've always appreciated his ability to display the structure of a piece. What is your dream concert? The goal of a concert is always to inspire and elevate audiences, but also to bring joy, beauty, and new musical discoveries into their lives. In the BBC Music Magazine for July of 2022, Richard Morrison outlines a music initiative in the UK which could revolutionize education. When orchestras aren't doing what the world expects them to do, dressing in formal black and playing symphonies in concert halls, they are often doing rather more exciting things. For instance, sending musicians like missionaries into schools, hospitals, factories, and shopping malls. Or pioneering new sounds by young composers in disused warehouses. A lot of that goes on, but it's often below the radar, unreported by the press. Well, I hope the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra's latest different project makes a huge splash, locally, nationally, and internationally, because it could transform musical life. The CBSO hasn't stopped being a proper orchestra, of course, but it will soon take on an additional role in Sandwell, one of the poorest boroughs in the West Midlands. The CBSO has teamed up with Sir Mark Grundy's Shireland Collegiate Academy Trust, which already runs a string of high-performing primary and secondary schools, to open a new school that will teach a full curriculum of subjects, but with special emphasis on music. Non-selective and non-fee-paying, it will in effect offer a private school level of music education led by CBSO mentors to children of many diverse ethnic backgrounds and from far from affluent families. The project has been in the pipeline since 2017, but in May this year it took a giant leap forward when building started on the chosen site in West Bromwich. To be called the Shireland CBSO Academy, the school will accept applications from this July and open its doors in September 2023, initially with six classes of Year 7 students and a Year 12 group, or sixth form as we wrinklies used to call it. By 2027, it should be catering for nearly 900 students aged 11 to 18. I hope the ripples spread far beyond the West Midlands. The biggest obstacle to the proper teaching of music in schools is not lack of money, though that is pretty daunting, but the wrong attitude. It's been the view of those in authority, whether politicians or educationalists, that the arts aren't serious academic pursuits. The people behind the new academy believe that this notion will be proved wrong by measuring the exam results of the school's pupils against those of normal state schools in the same area. This evidence will show that intensive immersion in music, far from distracting pupils from their other studies, increases their intellectual capabilities in all areas. All orchestras do educational work, but this is something deeper and potentially more transformative. So is the decision by a London-based ensemble, the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, to relocate itself, lock, stock, and baroque bassoons in a big, bustling North London comprehensive school, Ackland Burghley School in Tufnell Park. The idea is that there will be a synergy, a mutually beneficial exchange of experiences between musicians and students. It's early days yet. The OAE moved in only last year, but a similar project involving the Deutsche Kammerphilharmonie, which moved into a comprehensive school in Bremen, apparently produced remarkable improvements in pupils' academic performance as well as musical skills. My hope is that these radical projects will prompt other arts institutions to get involved in running schools. Imagine if, for example, English National Opera were to live up to its name and team up with an academy group to open a new comprehensive school in, say, Sunderland, that integrated singing and acting into every school day. Or if the Royal Shakespeare Company got involved in a new school in one of those culturally deprived South Yorkshire towns, such as Doncaster or Rotherham, a school that offered working-class children the kind of stage training those posh lads at Eton get, as a matter of course. Skeptics will argue that such ventures might be great for students at the schools concerned, but don't do anything for the rest. That even if every major arts institution in Britain founded its own academy, that would still leave millions of young people in schools without adequate arts teaching. True, but imagine the galvanizing effect on parents and educationalists when these new arts-run schools started producing students whose all-round academic achievements were matched by excellent musical or artistic skills. Wouldn't every state school be under pressure to produce the same results? Suddenly, the arts would be seen not as inessential luxuries in children's lives, but as the key to unlocking their full potential in every area. You've been listening to Classical Music Connection, brought to you each week by the Radio Reading Services of Greater Cincinnati, with generous support from Matinee Musicale Cincinnati. I'm your host, David Hatfield, inviting you to join me next week for Classical Music Connection.